But he was always there. He was for them, so to speak. And I'm not quoting Gail, but I think that kind of says what she was saying. What shows that here in these chapters that we've looked at and will be looking at? Could we say that God could be depended on? Would that be another way of putting what you were thinking? Carm? Okay, we didn't go a lot into a lot of the going through the Red Sea and so forth, but that it's in here in this lesson. So God led them out of Egypt. Moses led them out of Egypt. God led them out of Egypt by the hand of Moses, and the Egyptian followed. When the Israelites got to the Red Sea, the Israelites begin to wonder what's going to go on. There comes Pharaoh. But he could depend on God. He said he was going to help them, he'd be with them. He parted the Red Sea by the hand of Moses. And Carmen went on to mention that after they went through the Red Sea, what happened to the Egyptians? We all remember what happened when Charleston Heston railed up his... Yeah, okay. So they got down, they were going through the Red Sea and on dry land, water on each side. What were the Egyptians doing? They were following them, and there again we see the hand of God in protecting them by blowing up the Egyptians' chariots, right? Okay, grounded them is one way of putting it. Took their wheels off, another way of saying it did. Yeah. Yeah. Ted's bringing up what a lot of people who don't want to discredit the Bible and the account and everything, miracles, skeptics, another way of putting, higher critics is another way to describe them, that really it wasn't such a big deal for them to cross the Red Sea because it's really just a marsh and it was marshy land. And there he is there at the north end of the Red Sea, of that arm of it, a marsh. But Ted's question is, well, how could they drown in less than 2 feet of water, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, yeah, it's a quibble. Yes, go ahead, Laverne. I think of that too, and I thought of it when I asked the question. Laverne brings up the fact that it's impressive that when God called Moses, I didn't tell him, I want you to go back. Was that, you ever seen a bush on fire and never burned up? God appeared to Moses in that, as we call it, a burning bush, which is a misnomer in the sense that it didn't burn up. It didn't burn to a crisp and fall into the ashes. And that's where God approached Moses. What did he tell Moses to do? I know he told him, you're going to go back and leave my people out. But I mean, right there at the bush when God appeared to Moses or spoke to Moses. Take off your sandals. Yeah, take off your shoes, take off your sandals. Why? You're standing on holy ground. You mean when God appears to somebody like that, that's holy? If I go back there where Moses, we don't have any idea where it was, exact location. But suppose we went back and we were standing on that same spot, would it be holy? No. It was holy because God's presence was there with Moses. And Moses argued, that's where I call it arguing. Moses contended with God about going back because I'm not eloquent. What was one of the other things? They won't believe me. Is that right? If I tell them that. What did God say? Very quickly, we looked at this last week. What did God say to Moses? When he said, oh, I can't go back. I can't speak well. All right, I'll give you a mouthpiece. I'll give you Prophet Aaron, and Aaron will speak for you. And what else did he tell him you could show? What did Moses have in his hand? His staff. And then what did he tell him to do? Throw it on the ground, right? And it became a cow. Oh, a snake, pick it up by the tail, and it came his staff again. There's one other thing he told him to do. You go back and show the people that. Put his hand in his bosom, in his cloak, and what happened? He turned to leprosy. Ooh, put it back, and it came clean. Anything else that shows us the power, the magnificence? What else was my question about Jehovah God? Yes, Paul. Yeah.
Later on, we were a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire, and as they were moving around, that pillar of cloud moved around behind you, they realized you got between them and each
other. Okay. All right. Carm mentioned the pillar of fire and cloud as he was leading them out, but what Paul is saying here is that pillar of fire and cloud, God moved it around. He was in control. I mean, he caused it, of course, but he also caused it to move around. And when the Egyptians started following the Israelites, am I right about this, that he moved the cloud around behind them between the Israelites and the Egyptians? The indication there is here's the presence of God, and he's going to protect them. He certainly protected them when he had the water come back and drown the Egyptians. But also, the cloud and the pillar of fire were an indication of the presence of God. One was for daytime and one was for night. Which one would it be? That's a hard question. Pillar of fire by night. It would lead them by night. The cloud would lead them by day. And until they built the tabernacle, that was to them an indication that God is with us. We won't get into the building of the tabernacle in this lesson. But what did the tabernacle show to the people? Or remind them of, or let them know about. And I'm not asking that right. They built a tabernacle, as we call it, a tent. All the instructions are in the scriptures. God said, all right, I cannot dwell in tents made by man, but this tent is an indication of his presence with them. But inside that tent, there was something that was particularly an indication that he was with them. What was it? The Ark of the Covenant, right. Where was it located? That tent had two rooms in it. The most holy place, as we call it. And the mercy seat was there in the Ark of the Covenant. After they got through building that tent, God's glory filled it. And there's only one person was to go into it once a year, and that was the high priest, et cetera, et cetera. Anything else that shows something about God in these that you've thought of now? On the second side, or the second page of this, lesson number 7, at the top there, I'll just read that first paragraph, and I want to ask you something about it. In spite of the horrifying events of the plagues and the death of all the firstborn of Egypt, Pharaoh cannot concede the Israelites to God. He pursues them unto his destruction in the Red Sea, thus glorifying God in the eyes of the Egyptians, Ephesians 14, 13 through 18, and fostering belief among the Israelites. Exodus 14:30-31. Nevertheless, a glimpse of the future lies in this episode. The people murmur against God and Moses, even as they are delivered by God's miraculous power. That last thing is what somebody mentioned, I think, that the people murmured, even here, Exodus 14, 10, and 12. But I want to ask the question here. He pursues them, the second sentence, he pursues them unto his destruction. He pursues them unto his, okay, he pursues. I didn't even notice how that was worded. He pursues them unto his destruction in the Red Sea. He pursues them, the Egyptians, unto their destruction in the Red Sea. Thus, here's what I was going to ask about. Thus glorifying God in the eyes of the Egyptians. In the eyes of the Egyptian, that says the Egyptians glorified God. In their eyes, God was glorified. Did you ever think about that? I mean, oh, no, the Israelites should be ones who are going to be glorifying God, or their God is glorified in their eyes. And it says here, fostering belief among the Israel, among Israel. Is that statement correct, that thus glorifying God in the eyes of the Egyptians? You got your Bibles? You got chapter 14 of Exodus? The 25 is one of them. Before that, let's back up to verse 13. Moses said to the people, "Fear not." We read this last week, and this is one of the points we made for us today. Excuse me. Moses said to the people, "Fear not, stand firm, and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. And the Lord will fight for you, and you have only to be silent." The Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the people of Israel to go forward. Lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, that the people of Israel may go through the sea on dry ground. And I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them. And I will get glory over glory over Pharaoh and all his host, his chariots and his horsemen. And all the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gotten glory over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen." And drop down to verse 25 that someone mentioned. Verse 24, "And in the morning watch, the Lord in the pillar of fire and of cloud looked down on the Egyptian forces and threw the Egyptian forces into a panic, clogging," this version says. There's another word besides clogging. Anyway, one version says the wheels fell off or something like that. Anyway, clogging their chariot wheels so that they drove heavily. And the Egyptians said, "Let us flee before Israel, for the Lord," and that's the word Jehovah that we mentioned last week, "for Jehovah fights for them against the Egyptians." Now, when we ask this question here, how did in the eyes of the Egyptians, was God glorified? It's not meaning that they were converts and they said, "Well, he's Jehovah God in one sense and we'll follow him." That's not what, but they did recognize, isn't that what this is meaning? They recognized that God was fighting for Israel. He was helping them. We don't have power over this God that these people have. Is that right? So even in the eyes of the Egyptians, Jehovah God was glorified or held up in high esteem. That's really what that word glory means, or glorify. Let's look in the same chapter back up to verse, no, back down. We stopped at verse 25. Verse 30 and 31. After this happened, the people walked across on dry land, and the waters being a wall to them on the right and left. Thus the Jehovah saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Israel saw the great power that the Lord used against the Egyptians, so the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Jehovah and in his servant Moses. They feared the Lord. I don't know if that means afraid. There could have been some fear in that sense, but what is the word usually when we're talking about fearing Jehovah? What does it mean? Respect? Excuse me, that's a good word. Is it revered? Reverence? Awe? Should we fear God today? Should we have the, and this is what I was getting at in all those questions, should we have the same thoughts about God that we expressed a while ago, that he's powerful, he's willing to help, he's here. We don't see the cloud, we don't see the pillar of fire, or we don't see the waters parted. But should we have the same fear, the same respect, the same awe that would have been developed in those people today? Right. Yes, Ken.
Well, we see the water parted when we're buried in that grave.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul said that they going to the Red Sea were baptized under Moses.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Ken's, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. Ken's bringing up a thought that that we've mentioned in the past, that there are types and antitypes in the Old Testament and New Testament. And what passage is Ken referring to? Do you remember? It's in the New Testament. I'll give you that hint. 1 Corinthians 10. Turn there. Paul says, I wouldn't have you ignorant, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud. Okay, they were under the cloud in this particular instance, and all passed through the sea, and were all immersed unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea. So the top is cloud, sea on each side. They are immersed in it, right? Verse 3, and did all eat the same spiritual food, and did all drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank of the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ. Howbeit, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness, and that's in our future study of Leviticus and Numbers, etc. So we have a type here of what Paul says is takes place in baptism, as I told you last week, that's not a translation of the word. People were immersed. They were baptized is the way that most versions put it. It shows us a picture of what baptism is, and it's immersion. They were baptized in the cloud and in the sea, and the rock that followed them was what or who? The Christ. All right. So, would that be an argument for Jesus being in the Old Testament, or the Word is a better word, being in the Old Testament? We usually think of, and it's true that Jesus was born in New Testament time, as we call it, but was the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit back in Old Testament days? Is that a hard question? Yeah, there you go. Laverne says, John 1:1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. The Word was God. Who was the Word? Who became what?
Christ,
Jesus. Yeah, God, start out Genesis 1, right? Elohim said to Elohim, let's make man in our image. We're getting off the subject, but go ahead, Ted. Oh, I said it? Great minds run the same channel. All right. let's see, we read verse 25 of Exodus 14. Well, I'll go ahead and look at these two questions here, 6 and 7. What had the Egyptians and the Israelites failed to learn from the plagues? Now, first of all, let me ask something about this question. What did the Israelites fail to learn? Why did he, whoever wrote this question, why did he say that not only the Egyptians but the Israelites, they failed to learn something from the plagues? What had they not learned? What indicates that they hadn't learned? God's power, more specific. Yeah. Let's see if I can word it differently. What would cause this person to write this question? What had the Egyptians? That's easy. We know what they failed to learn from the plagues. But what had the Israelites failed to learn? God's power, yes. But go ahead. Maybe I'm not asking the right question. Gail and then Ted. Gail's first.
Is it kind of like if the Israelites were knew that God existed, is it possible that they were learning that he can act right now, like right there in front of your face?
He can. That's part of it. Yeah, they can act right now. Yeah. How else to say it? Okay, maybe Ted will help us. If God would not forsake them, that's part of it too. But what indicated that? Maybe that's the way I'm trying to ask the question. What indicated that they didn't realize God would not forsake them, or that God can do it right now? Yeah. What did they do that indicates? Carm? Carm, go ahead. Okay, that's down in the history of ways when the 12 spies were sent out. They forgot that God would help them. Ted, go ahead. Okay. Kramer? I think Kent had his hand up. Go ahead, Kramer. I've got you right now. Okay, I think that may be what I'm thinking of. And where were they in chapter 13, verse what?
11 and 12.
Where were? Pardon me. Okay, in chapter 13 of Exodus, starts at verse 10. Where were they?
14. Chapter 14.
Oh, I'm sorry. Chapter 14, verse 13. Okay. Where were they? Over in Canaan?
They're facing the water.
They're facing the Red Sea.
Yep.
And what'd they say? What'd they do?
The Egyptians are bearing down on them, so they are in a pickle.
They're in a bind. They're in a pickle. They're in a... Wow. Look at there. They're coming after us. And what do they say?
They're very frightened. They cry out to the Lord. Is it because there are no graves in Egypt, you've taken us away to die in the wilderness?
Did that show lack of faith in the plagues? Lack of faith in God. That's the immediate part of this question here. Was there something else? Ken, did I overlook something you wanted to say?
Similar to what happened there for years
Okay. Yeah.
We're not there yet. We don't know what's going on.
Except in the sense that if we've been immersed, we're already come out of the water. But we still have faced the same things that they did to test our faith, if you want to put it that way. Right. Okay. There's still others to come behind us. We're already out of the water and headed if we've been immersed into Christ. All right. Thank you. Let's see. Now, there's something else here. What had the Egyptians and the Israelites failed to learn? Well, the Egyptians failed to learn the power of God. I mean, that's evident. That's not a hard question. Jehovah's power, unlimited. You can't win against him. And the same to us today. That's what I was going to get at, too. We need to learn that. Question 7, why did the Egyptians try to flee once in the midst of the Red Sea? We've read verse 25. Well, let's get out of here. That water's coming back. And they couldn't get out fast enough because their chariots bogged down in the, or however you want to say it. Okay. This next section, God's testing of Israel. And this carries us in chapter 15, 16, and 17. I'll not read all of that, but there are 1, 2, 3, 4 tests at least that they are tested here. At Mount Sinai, they must learn the lessons of God, care for them and their need to obey. Murmuring is the key word. They murmured about being thirsty, Exodus 15. They murmured about being hungry. Now, this is after they come out, of course, the Red Sea and the Egyptians being killed. They murmured about being hungry. And they murmured about being thirsty again, chapter 17. But the elements, this passage says, was not just the enemies were not just the elements, that is, thirst and hungry. The Amalekites threatened the people. And that's when God had Moses hold up his arms when they were fighting the Amalekites in chapter 17. And Moses, he held up both arms, didn't he? As long as Moses held up his arms, the Israelites prevailed. He got tired. Did he have help? Who helped him? Moses holding up his arms, they win the battle. We've forgotten that answer? Did he have somebody help him hold up his arms? Who was it? Was it Aaron? I'm not sure either. You tell me. Okay, no. A question about this. Murmuring. They were tested when they didn't have enough water. They were tested when they got hungry. What was one of the things they said when they were hungry? It shows that they really had failed the test in one way. When they murmured, we don't. Yes, Paul. We had better food. We had Egypt. What did they like back in Egypt? Melons? There's several things. Onions? Leeks? Garlic? Am I right? Don't need to, that's no big deal. So they murmured when they were tested. They murmured again several times when they were thirsty. Did the Israelites ever tempt God? Careful, that's a question that's got a little other meaning behind it. Now you're not going to answer. Did the Israelites, they were tested by God when they were thirsty, when they were hungry. Did the Israelites ever test, oh, I said the word. Did the Israelites ever tempt God? Some versions use that word. They tempted God. And I bring it up because somewhere it says that God can't be tempted. All right? Book of James. James chapter 1. I say it because I know some people would not understand. I don't think you don't understand. But some would, when they read it, God, they tempted God. They're in the wilderness, or they're after they got out of the Red Sea, and when they're thirsty and so on. They tested God in that sense. It wasn't a temptation to sin, of course, as James says. Question number 10, how did the Israel tempt God in these things? He uses that word in question number 10. And that's Exodus 17, verse 7. Let's go over there. Let's see how many versions say Exodus 17, verse 7. He called the name of the place Massah and Meribah because of the quarreling of the people of Israel, and because they, this version says, tested the Lord by saying, is the Lord among us or not? Your versions. Well, mine said here that I just read, they tested God. Does any of your versions say tempted? Okay, I got two hands. And that's the reason this person who wrote question number 10 used that word. But I thought I would clarify, as you already know, that God is not tempted in the sense we usually think of temptation. But they tested God's patience for sure, didn't they? Did they test anybody else's patience as they were going through the wilderness on the way to the promised land? Did they test anybody else besides God? That's a kind of a vague question. Did I didn't hear it? Moses, somebody said back there. Why would you say that Moses was tested by the people? We're way ahead of Exodus, you know. And we're going in time, going ahead quite a ways.
Several factors.
Go ahead.
One is there's a lot of people. And he's a little overwhelmed with leadership.
Okay. Okay.
And generating the complaining and the murmuring, is that what you're getting at? They're not trusting in Jehovah, and that frustrates him.
Okay. The first thing that Brian mentioned is something in paragraph number 5 here that we'll get to in just a moment. They tested Moses with all the problems they brought to him. We'll talk about that if we have time, just a second. Can you think of an occasion where Moses, it really got to him? And I'm talking about some time from where we are right now. Carm?
I don't know what you think, but just previous to what we read there about the Lord being tested when Moses struck the rock.
Okay. One time they said, we're thirsty, we need some water. So God told him the first time, bring forth water, and he did. Did he hit the rock that time? Check me on the first time that happened. The next time, when they were thirsty, Moses, hear now, ye rebels, we bring forth water, and God didn't tell him to strike any, and he did. I think he was pretty frustrated then. He was pretty much tested. That's what I was getting at. Okay, good. In this paragraph number 5, the nation in need of government is the point here that is being made. But why is this thought that the nation was in need of government? And he goes on to say a society of the size of Israel needs social controls, laws, courts, leadership, instruction, and so on. And Jethro's father-in-law suggested to Moses, Since every problem was brought to Moses and he had to deal with it, it became overwhelming by the number of people that were coming. And it says here that the strain on Moses suggests a delegation, Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, delegation of responsibility, and Exodus the 18th. And he suggested to Moses, well, appoint elders. That's one of the words they used, isn't it? How many were there? Don't answer that now. If you think of it, fine. They appointed men who would take care of some of the responsibility of making judgments for the people. And so anyway, this person suggests that the size of Israel and the needs for social controls, laws, etc., and the need for proper justice when people brought problems needed to be spread out among more than just Moses. And then in that last sentence, it says, this foreshadows the establishment of a comprehensive law between God and Israel, which will further define the people as a nation and preserve them under God's future purpose for them. So this is the establishment of order in among the people, social order as well as spiritual, if you're going to put it that way, and is probably the beginning of the elders, which resulted in the elders of the Sanhedrin. There were 70 men that were chosen to be the Sanhedrin, or the Supreme Court. During New Testament days, that's what they were called, the Sanhedrin. This is the precedent for that. And so the men were appointed or chosen, and that relieved Moses with the stress that he was under. Now, if you have a question or comment you'll make on that, well, we'll consider it in a minute. But here he says society the size of Israel needs social controls, laws, courts, leadership, instruction, and so on. What's the purpose of law? And that's not the purpose. What is a purpose of law? And I'm getting into some of the instruction in the New Testament here. Is law given for the righteous? Go ahead, Ken. Okay. Law tells us what's wrong. That's what Paul said. That's what Ken said. I had another thought I was going to add to that. Would there be chaos without law? Is law made for the person who is righteous? That was another question that I started to ask. Okay. Protect the innocent? Okay. But if I am completely perfect, sinless, do I need law? Now that's an if, of course. Ken, go ahead. Okay, that's where our Moses came in. Right, that's where Jesus came in. Right. One other thing before our time's gone here. It says that this foreshadows the establishment of a comprehensive law between God and Israel. This thought was brought up in our Wednesday evening class several weeks ago. God made a covenant with the people. And what kind of covenant, or what is, not kind, what is a covenant with God? What is, do you ever make a covenant? Have you ever made a covenant today?
Like signing contract.
It's an agreement. You bought a house, you bought a car, you signed the papers. When I bought a car, I dickered with, as that's a word we use, I argued with him. I said no, and he said, well, how about this? I said, yeah, okay, and I said no, and he said, and so finally we signed the contract, we signed the agreement. Is that what God does? This is what I'm getting at. When God makes a covenant, he says, here's my will, here's my covenant. Did they dicker with him? No, they didn't dicker at him at all. God's covenant is not a type of contract. Now, the people did say, we will follow it. They did commit themselves to it, but they didn't make any amendments to it or anything like that. You think about that. That's the way God is. And we still do the same. We make an agreement with God, because after he says, this is my will, but he didn't ask us to amend it or anything like that. Our time's gone. And next week, let me hand out lesson number 8, and next week we'll start with that. Well, I wish we had more time, but maybe next week you can convince Brian to come back to it. All right. When the time's gone here, we hand these out and take the sheet.
Elder, yes. Just say one thing real quick.
Quick.
God's word is not negotiable.
God's word is not negotiable. That's right. Okay, thank you very much.